Over the course of more than 30 years in the 13th century, one of the greatest philosophers of the Middle Ages, Albertus Magnus, traveled to the four corners of Europe, as far north as Scotland, as far east as the Baltic Sea, south to Sicily, and west to the coast of France, all in his efforts to research the nature of animals. He made this epic journey on foot, earning him the nickname Boots the Bishop. He studied the habits of weasels, spent time on a ship observing the whaling industry, examined the fossilized remains of insects, and pored through the writings of Greek and Arabic philosophers. His resultant corpus, by far the largest encyclopedia on zoology ever produced in the West to that point, took 4 years to write, runs to over 800 pages, and describes almost 500 distinct species. Moving to the present day, 700 years later, I was able to sit down in my most comfortable armchair at my wirelessly connected computer and find out in seconds that there are currently 1,250,000 species in the world, from the penguins of Antarctica to the boa constrictors of South America to the zebras of Africa. The great scientific knowledge about animals, which separates the Middle Ages and our own time, was neatly summed up recently by a young visitor to my current exhibition, Medieval Beasts, with the disdainful comment, "Dragons, who would be stupid enough to believe that?" These days, any 10-year-old has instant access to information about every kind of animal in the world, with downloadable images just a click away. But tonight, I invite you back hundreds of years to the Middle Ages, when most people never ventured further than the countryside around their hometowns, and their only knowledge of the lands beyond Europe came from books. Books often illustrated with amazing and fantastic creatures. In fact, the art of the Middle Ages absolutely abounds in imagery of unbelievable animals. Perhaps at no other time in the history of Western art have beasts played such a dominant role. The noble unicorn really regally holds court in tapestries. Mythological creatures cavort under the seats of wooden choir stalls. Horrific dragons peer out from the tops of marble church columns. And griffins were fashioned out of metal for use at table during feasts. But it was in the pages of manuscripts that medieval artists truly let loose their talents in depicting the creatures of the unknown. Tonight's lecture will focus on the different types of fantastic creatures found in manuscripts, including their origins, their use in a Christian European context, their role in perceptions of the afterlife, and their appearance in romances and travelogues. Along the way, we will explore how those in the Middle Ages regarded beasts in an attempt to explain why fantastic animals were so adept at capturing the medieval imagination. Before we begin to explore the world of beasts in the Middle Ages, it is necessary to put ourselves first in the mindset of medieval Christian Europeans and realize that their frame of reference was quite different from ours. We make clear distinctions now between the animals which we encounter every day, such as dogs, horses, and squirrels, exotic animals we may see in zoos, like lions, monkeys, and camels, and fantastic creatures that we agree are imaginary, like dragons, unicorns, and sirens. In the Middle Ages, however, all these different kinds of creatures were each understood simply as individual parts of a single whole that was God's magnificent and vast plan for the world. Aside from the animals commonly found in rural Europe, all of these creatures were equally unknown except through written accounts and pictures. Just imagine if you had never been to a zoo or seen an encyclopedia, and someone described to you an animal weighing more than 10,000 pounds with the skin of a lizard, enormous ears, tusks, and a nose almost 6 feet long. To those in the Middle Ages, this description of an elephant called an elephant would seem just as fantastic as an account of a dragon. As physical creatures, they were both equally unknown and unknowable. It is no surprise, then, that medieval artists often faced a dilemma in coming up with visual representations of these creatures. Having little beyond a written description of a beast of immense size with a long nose and big ears, and having nothing for physical reference but products made from elephant ivory brought to Europe by traders, such as this medieval hunting horn, is it any wonder that instead of a drawing of an elephant like this, a medieval artist would cobble together something like this, in which the elephant looks kind of like a Labrador with a nice ivory horn for a nose. Although we may consider this drawing as naively humorous now, its intended purpose in the Middle Ages was nonetheless achieved. The image comes from a portion of text describing the wonders of India, and its medieval readers no doubt were suitably amazed at the mystery and exotic appeal of this far-off place. For those in the Middle Ages, elephants, dragons, unicorns, camels, sirens, and griffins were all fantastic creatures who lurked beyond the bounds of Europe. Many people mistakenly believe that fantastic animals were the result of the overactive imaginings of the medieval mind. The Middle Ages, however, inherited the vast majority of these creatures from Greek and Roman antiquity. Classical literature, read as avidly in the Middle Ages as it is today, was full of fantastic creatures. Oedipus riddled by the Sphinx, Odysseus lured by the call of sirens, and the centaur Chiron, who battled at the gates of Troy. Additional unnatural beasts were described at length by an unexpected source, one of the greatest minds the world has ever produced, Aristotle. In his History of Animals, he details the appearance and habits of vicious manticores, savage unicorns, fire-resistant salamanders, and enormous dragons. Aristotle's text was known mainly in the Middle Ages through the efforts of Pliny the Elder, a later Greek scholar who borrowed liberally from Aristotle's work. Pliny's Natural History was one of the most influential works of the Middle Ages and served as the basis of many later medieval texts, including that of Albertus Magnus, our 13th century friend, who relied on Pliny for descriptions of species living in lands where his feet could not take him. Those in the Middle Ages held the writings of the Greeks almost in awe, particularly those of Aristotle. And since it was well known that Aristotle had heard of these creatures firsthand from Alexander the Great, who saw them himself during his travels in India, there was little question as to whether they really existed. What the Europeans struggled with was how to fit these unnatural beasts into a Christian worldview. Questions such as whether these creatures lived in the Garden of Eden troubled medieval scholars and forced some rethinking of the nature of God's divine plan. The early medieval theologian, Augustine, posited that these creatures reaffirmed God's supreme power and his desire to inspire man with a sense of the marvelous. Vincent of Beauvais, later in the Middle Ages, reasoned that the fact that such unnatural beasts exist was a type of miracle in itself that only God could accomplish in the face of nature. The authenticity of these creatures received further support from an even more unimpeachable source, the Bible. Unicorns appear in Numbers and Isaiah, dragons in Jeremiah and Malachi, and the sea monster Leviathan in Psalms. With such authority affirming their reality, it became common to show fantastic animals as part of God's design for the world. In this image of the creation, a unicorn pokes its head up proudly amongst the other animals. Likewise, the image here shows Adam naming the animals in the Garden of Eden. Among them is a wingless dragon, a griffin, and some kind of frog-like creature. Not sure what that is. Because God had created these creatures of the earth as symbols of the divine plan that was inherent in every aspect of the natural world, the characteristics of each animal eventually came to be seen as representing specific aspects of the relationship between the human and the divine. The text that explained these connections at length became one of the most popular books of the Middle Ages, the Bestiary. The Bestiary was a kind of encyclopedia of animals, but unlike modern encyclopedias, which explain the physical characteristics, habitat, and eating preferences of animals, medieval bestiaries explored the world of animals solely in order to explain their significance within the Christian worldview. The Bestiary had its origins in a text created for the Greek court called the Physiologus. Following the structure of that text, bestiaries were divided, logically enough, into animals of the air, such as peacocks and bats, animals on land, like hedgehogs and elephants, and animals of the sea, like whales and fish. Within those categories, however, domesticated, exotic, and imaginary animals were all mixed in together. And even when it was a real animal rather than a mythical one, the description of the habits and behaviors of the creatures often sounds rather surprising to modern ears. Some of these were simple misunderstandings of natural phenomena that were emphasized in order to highlight the Christian interpretation that followed. The lion, for instance, was described as giving birth to dead cubs. After 3 days, their father would gently breathe life into their little bodies. And this guy has always kind of reminded me of a smirking car salesman, but he's doing a good job nonetheless. The revival of the cubs after 3 days of death was understood to be a natural reflection of the story of Christ's crucifixion and his resurrection 3 days later. The story, however, may have been based on reality, since lion cubs are born with their eyes sealed shut, and they do not open them until several days after birth. In other cases, the stories found in bestiaries are sheer fantasy. Beavers, and believe it or not, this is a beaver. Beavers in the Middle Ages were highly prized for the medicinal value of their testicles. According to the legend told in the bestiary, beavers would willingly tear off their own testes to avoid being killed by hunters, the moral being that any true Christian should be willing to sacrifice anything, even his nearest and dearest apparently, to escape being caught by the devil. The story is about as realistic as the artist's misrepresentation of the animal's appearance. And yet, the essence of the tale, which probably seemed unfamiliar to most of you, still survives to this day. The Latin name for the beaver is castor, related to the English word castrate. What is interesting about the case of the beaver is that beavers were indigenous to Europe, yet this imaginary depiction of its habits was as far off as the depiction of its form. It is evident that those reading the bestiary were less concerned with scientifically observed animal behaviors or even the physical appearance of the beast in question, but rather viewed each creature primarily in terms of its symbolic relationship to the divine. In addition to the real beasts found in the bestiary were a whole host of what we would term imaginary animals. The unicorn, for example, was said in the text to be excessively elusive, conveniently explaining why most people had never seen one. The bestiary clarifies that it could, quote, only be caught in the following fashion. A girl who is a virgin is led to a place where it dwells and is left there alone in the forest. As soon as the unicorn sees her, it leaps into her lap and embraces her and goes to sleep there. Then the hunters capture it and display it in the king's palace. The single horn on the unicorn's head was understood to signify the unity of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. While the reference to the virgin evokes the Virgin Mary, and the deceived unicorn, the betrayal of Christ. In this image, however, the virgin's nudity and the suggestive position of the unicorn's outstretched horn could bring to mind a decidedly secular interpretation. Some of the more incredible animals in the bestiary took a humorous turn. Quote, in Asia, there is an animal called the bonasan that has horns that wind back on themselves so that anyone who falls on them is not wounded. The protection which is denied to this monster through its horns is provided by its belly. When it flees, the excrement from the stomach of this beast produces such a stench over an area of 2 acres that its heat singes everything it touches. The artist has taken advantage of this description to show flames actively shooting from the creature's rear, while the hunter reflexively ducks. You may be waiting for the moral of the story, but you will wait in vain in the case of the bonasan. Apparently, this is one tale for which even medieval theologians couldn't find a corresponding virtue or vice. The habits of the dragon are described in great detail by the bestiary. Quote, the dragon is larger than all other animals in the world. Its strength is not in its teeth, but in its tail, and it harms more by blows than by force of impact. Not even the elephant, with its huge body, is safe from it. It lies concealed near the paths which elephants are in the habit of using, entangles their feet with its coils, and suffocates them to death. Its homes are in Ethiopia and India, where there is always heat. And to me, it seems that this elephant is just as surprised to see a dragon as we would be. The story is an allegory for the behavior of the devil, who is known to lurk along the path to salvation, waiting to trip up unwary Christians and suffocate their souls by twining the coils of sin around them. The dragon would remain probably the single most recognizable symbol for the devil throughout the Middle Ages, and not just in the bestiary. Dragons were among the primary antagonists of saints from the early Christian era onwards. Based on the same widespread notions about dragons found in the bestiary, the saints' battles against dragons were seen as spiritual struggles as much as they were physical ones. The ability to slay a dragon became a metaphor for the triumph of the Christian spirit over the powers of evil. Two of the most famous and beloved examples were St. George and St. Margaret. The story of St. George was Eastern in origin, and I show an icon here from the East, brought back to the West by Crusaders in the 12th century, where it was told and retold with great relish, gaining ever more fantastical elements as it went along. According to the legend, the town of Cyllene in Libya was under constant threat from a plague-bearing dragon who was appeased every day by feeding it a virgin, the virgins being chosen by lottery from among the town's inhabitants. Then one day, the lot fell to the princess of Cyllene. St. George heard of this and rode to the town, where he found the princess decked out in bridal finery, trembling before the lake where the dragon lived. The dragon appeared from the lake, and St. George charged it on horseback and thrust his spear into its body. The thankful townspeople offered St. George the wealth of a king, but he refused and asked instead that they all convert to Christianity. Maybe not what I would ask for, but good enough. The story ends with the townspeople, the king, and the princess receiving baptism. In this case, the dragon is a clear symbol of paganism, which is overcome and replaced by Christianity. To underscore the connection, St. George is usually shown, as he is here, as a gallant medieval crusader straight out of a romance, where he could just as easily pass for Lancelot or Galahad. The story of St. Margaret also serves as a clear allegory. Margaret was the daughter of a powerful pagan priest who cast her out for her devotion to Christianity. Forced to live in the countryside and tend sheep, the young woman was spotted one day by a Roman prefect who instantly fell in love with her beauty. He offered to marry her, and when she refused, he denounced her as a Christian and brought her to trial. While in her jail cell, Satan, in the form of a dragon, came and swallowed her whole. Luckily, the resourceful saint had her handy cross with her at all times and cut her way out of the side of the dragon. In most images of the saints, such as these, the dragon has barely had time to swallow the young girl, as is evidenced by the fact that she emerges even before the dragon has finished swallowing her dress. Although the symbolism of the story is clear from the way the cross proves to be Satan's undoing, the story is also similar to one found in the bestiary. Here we see the hydrus, worthy enemy of the crocodile. And yes, again, this is a crocodile. When the hydrus sees a crocodile, he rolls himself in mud and slides down the throat of the sleeping reptile. Once inside, the hydrus tears open a hole in the crocodile's side and comes out whole and unharmed. As the bestiary explains, this is a metaphor for the way Christ descended into hell. Having been crucified on the cross, Christ was able to descend into the nether regions and tear open its innards, whereupon he led forth those who were unjustly held there. The similarities between the two stories, not just in their moral content, but in their iconographic resemblances, is striking. The hydrus, like Margaret, exits even as he enters, and serves as a symbol of the ability to overcome evil through the power of the crucified Christ. Other lesser-known saint stories also involve dragons, as in the case of Martha, whom some of you may know from the famous story in the New Testament of the sisters Mary and Martha who entertained Christ in their home. What is perhaps less known, because it is found in apocryphal stories rather than the Bible, is that after Christ's death, Mary and Martha set sail and landed in France, where they spread Christianity. One day in the course of their preaching, Martha came upon a town where a great dragon, half beast and half fish, was killing the local inhabitants and sinking ships. She came upon said dragon while it was eating one of the worthy townspeople, and calmly sprinkled holy water on the beast, paralyzing it instantly. She then removed her belt and handily tied up the dragon so that it could be conveniently slain. And to me, she looks like an owner who's slightly miffed at her pet for continuing to eat table scraps. What's important about this story, however, is that it places both Martha and a dragon in France. Martha was a known figure in the Bible, and since it was preferable for French people in the Middle Ages to think that Martha herself had made France the first Christian nation in Europe, why doubt her presence there? And if she was in France, why wouldn't the rest of the story be true? There was ample proof for those in the Middle Ages that dragons, though perhaps scarce in the medieval West, were nonetheless real creatures who had wreaked havoc over the centuries as the devil's chosen representative on earth. While dragons were believed to roam the world, persecuting Christian and pagan alike, even more incredible and frightening creatures were said to await in the afterlife. Although the demons, devils, and dragons that were described in the biblical apocalypse were all understood to inhabit the future, they seemed no less real to those in the Middle Ages. The Bible's account of the end of the world is filled with incredible events, most of them involving pain and suffering for the victims unfortunate enough to witness them. Plagues, fires, earthquakes, and seas turning to blood are just some of the many catastrophes in store. But it is above all the frightening creatures who will descend on the ill-fated remains of humanity that arouse the greatest sense of terror and despair. The visionary nature of the apocalypse, along with its detailed visual descriptions, has always made the text ideal for illustration. But the narrative originality, use of color, and startling formal vocabulary used by artists in the Middle Ages to give tangible life to its text made it one of the most distinctive and fantastic types in the history of manuscript illumination, giving us some of the most memorable and haunting images ever created. Perhaps the most famous beasts described in the book of Revelation are the four horsemen of the apocalypse. As shown in this English manuscript from around 1250, the white horse will bring pestilence to the earth, and his rider represents conquest. The second, red in color, has the power to slaughter, and his rider symbolizes war. A third, black horse, will scorch the fields, and his rider will bring famine and plague. The last horse, who is pale, finally brings death and is followed by Hades, represented here by an open hell mouth with demons and the condemned spilling from its jaws. The arrival of the four horses heralds the coming of the last judgment. In these images, each horse and rider radiates a fierce physical presence, and the devastation they will inflict was seen as a prelude to the end of the world. Terrifying though they are, these horses, familiar from countless artistic and literary representation, are perhaps the least horrific of all the beasts sent to the earth at the end of time. After a series of other minor inflictions, including fire-breathing horses and horned beasts arising from the abyss of hell, three unclean spirits, each more powerful and frightening than the last, will demand the world's attention. First is the false prophet, in the shape of an ugly horned ape with cloven hooves and red talons, whose intent is to mislead. He is followed by the fearsome seven-headed dragon, who will attack the faithful. Finally comes the spotted seven-headed beast, who will receive the adoration of the earth. Each spits out lies and deceptions in the form of poisonous frogs that fly from their mouths. The vision is in fact so appalling that St. John, who witnessed these events and wrote them down, is forced to use his fingers to pry open his own eyes, a detail incorporated by the artist to emphasize the harsh reality of the scene. As we turn from English manuscripts to Spanish apocalypses of an earlier era, we trade Gothic gracefulness for highly colored schematic forms which emphasize the brutality and violence of the events at the end of the world. These two images, both from Spanish manuscripts, show conceivably the most terrifying of all the creatures, with the basic shape of horses, but altered into something new and horrible by the grafting on of other animal parts. The text recounts, "And from the smoke of the pit there came out locusts upon the earth, and power was given to them. And it was given to them that they should not kill men, but that they should torment them for 5 months. And the shape of the locusts were like unto horses prepared for battle. And on their heads were crowns like gold. And their faces were as the faces of men. And they had the hair of women, and their teeth were as lions. And they had breastplates of iron, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of chariots. And they had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. And in those days men shall seek death, and shall find it not. And they shall desire to die, and death will flee from them. The poetic words of the Apocalypse heighten the sense of despair when these creatures will descend to torment and inflict unimaginable suffering, suffering without the release of death. Unfortunately, all of these events are merely a prelude to the final battle. This two-page spread from an 11th-century Spanish manuscript captures the vastness, horror, and significance of this ultimate war for man's soul. The seven-headed dragon is let loose upon the earth. A battalion of angels diligently attacks its many heads, while others attempt to chain Satan in the very depths of hell. The dragon is so enormous that it captures a third of the stars with its tail and threatens the woman clothed with the sun. It is only with the appearance of Saint Michael the Archangel that the tide turns for those fighting on the side of good. In this image from a German Romanesque manuscript, Michael appears superbly confident and calm as he forces his spear and shield into the beast's open mouth. Around his serene figure, the battle rages as other angels fight a great variety of demons, impaling them with hooks, slicing at them with swords, and in one case, even riding on a demon's back before he whacks him on the head with his sword. The angels win the last battle in the end, but for some, the suffering has just begun. If there were a definitive competition among all artists of all time periods for representing the horrors of the afterlife and hell, medieval illuminators would win hands down. The graphic quality of the illuminations medieval artists produced assured the viewer that hell was a place where endless physical tortures were inflicted on the damned by a variety of demons, devils, and beasts. Medieval artists were unparalleled in dreaming up these creatures and the inventive torments they imposed. In this image, salvation in heaven is contrasted with damnation in hell in easy-to-grasp visual terms. Above, a man's soul is safely carried to paradise, while below, a sinful soul receives his just deserts. It is hard to imagine a more horrific scene. The naked terror on the man's face is certainly justified. To the upper left, a winged demon shoots a gun at the condemned man from close range, and the bullet goes directly into his mouth. Below, a greenish-blue creature gleefully prepares to rip out his entrails. To the right, a beast, seemingly half-dog and half-reptile, is just about to chew off the man's hand. Perhaps most alarming of all, we notice that the man is chained, and the chain leans to a horned demon who drags away the body with grim purpose to tortures yet unknown. This extraordinary illumination gives a sweeping view of hell with all its attendant chaos and confusion. Souls are pulled this way and that, choked, prodded, pierced, and singed. The master of all this suffering lies on an enormous grill. Inspired by the Old Testament book of Job, the creature is described in the following way. Out of his nostrils streams smoke, like that of a pot heated and boiling. His breath kindles coal, and a flame comes forth out of his mouth. His breath erupts here in a steady stream of unfortunate souls who will no doubt fall again to the depths of hell to experience other myriad tortures. Red and black dominate the image, and we finally find out just how the heat of hell is maintained at an even million degrees. A legion of demons operates bellows at all times. The illumination, appropriately enough, accompanies a series of prayers called the Office of the Dead. Meant to be used when someone died, the prayers were often also said every day as a reminder that death could come at any time. One of the most imaginative and extensive renderings of the realms of hell is offered by one of the Getty's masterpieces, The Visions of the Knight Tandal. Tandal was a knight who was given the extraordinary opportunity to see the horrors of hell firsthand, on a tour with an angel trying to convince him to reform his wicked ways. And Tandal is shown as a naked soul protected from all these horrible beasts by the presence of an angel. During the course of his tour, Tandal witnesses the tortures dealt out by a wide variety of hellish beasts to sinners. In fact, each sin merits its own special treatment in hell. Here, Tandal is shown the beast Acheron, devourer of the greedy. The huge creature rolls its eyes as flames of blue, red, and white escape from its gaping jaws. Two hapless souls are impaled by its teeth, keeping the dreadful maw of the beast open and displaying the writhing forms of the unlucky souls within. Tandal seems to plead with the angel to move along as quickly as possible. My favorite image, perhaps, is this one, which depicts the punishment reserved for unchaste priests and nuns. A dragon-like creature, half bird and half reptile, gobbles up the souls, after which they are liquefied in its stomach. The remains are then excreted onto a lake of ice, where the souls are reconstituted into human form. Unfortunately, they've been made pregnant with dozens of iron-beaked serpents who eat their way out from the inside. Ooh. Then the entire cycle begins again. Tandal seems to be trying to edge away from the creature in the image, but because he was guilty of the sin of lust, the angel condemns Tandal to go through one whole cycle through the beast before rescuing him and leading him on. Based on the experiences both with and within these various creatures, Tandal makes the right decision in the end and completely reforms, giving away all of his money, living in abstinence, and devoting himself to the sick and the poor. I always think, after all, I think I would have too. We have so far concentrated on how the Christian worldview influenced the depiction and understanding of fantastic animals in the Middle Ages. From the elephants of the bestiary to the demons of hell, all of these creatures had two things in common. First, each one was interpreted to have a specific meaning in the Christian world. And secondly, that meaning was always a reflection of the relationship between the man and the divine. Western Europe in the Middle Ages was unusually cohesive in being united by a single religion, Catholicism. That solidarity produced a logical corollary, xenophobia. Most of the animals that were believed to live beyond the boundaries of Europe were seen to be inimical to man. Their unknown quality instantly made them suspect. And yet fear of these animals was also accompanied by a sense of awe and wonder. People feared these creatures, but since they were never likely to see them in their lifetimes, they were also captivated by them. Even in terms of the demons of hell, each person in the Middle Ages was engaged in a lifelong hope that those particular creatures would never be encountered. So people could be mesmerized by what the afterlife held for pagans, Jews, sinners, in other words, someone else. Indeed, scholar Ruth Mellenkopf has even suggested that the appearance of these multitudinous demons, dragons, and other animals can be explained as an effort to ward off evil. The images of these creatures protected the viewer from their machinations. Today, the same fascination with exotic creatures explains why we watch alligator wrestlers, snake charmers, and horror movies where killer mutant spiders, bats, and wolves roam the streets. We wouldn't want it to happen to us, but it has a hypnotic quality that entrances us. For those in the Middle Ages, fantastic animals were an inexhaustible source of attraction. It comes as no surprise, then, that literature purporting to tell of the actual encounters between these beasts and men abounded in the Middle Ages. We will now turn to these adventure tales to see how artists illuminated romances and travelogues, building on the expectations of medieval Christians. As was the case with the bestiary, the tradition of medieval literature featuring fantastic animals had its origin in Greek works. One of the most popular romances of the Middle Ages was the Romance of Alexander. Alexander the Great was known to have traveled to and conquered vast areas of the East. The legends that grew up around his travels were largely based on a series of fictional letters which he was said to have written to his mentor Aristotle during his journeys. I spoke earlier about Aristotle's History of Animals as a source of knowledge for medieval encyclopedias, but it also served to those writing literature. The earliest known Alexander romances date to the Greek court in the 3rd century, and the legend was continually revised and augmented throughout the course of the next 1,000 years. Some of Alexander's exploits with animals became among the most popular legends associated with him. Here we see the story of Alexander and the griffins in 2 different manuscripts. According to the legend, Alexander was curious about the heavens above the earth, so he constructed a machine for ascending into the air. The vehicle was drawn by griffins, who were lured into continuing their ascent by meat held above them on sticks, looking rather like cotton candy in that case. This clever ploy not only helped Alexander control the griffins, but it also became a symbol of Alexander's great intellect and resourcefulness. Thus, the image at left appears in a romance of his life, but the image at right appears in a Bible. Alexander is mentioned, but only briefly in the Bible, in 1 Maccabees, as the great conqueror of Persia. And the episode with the griffins is, of course, not part of that passage. But knowledge of the event was so widespread that it was judged an appropriate beginning to 1 of the books of Scripture. Although some of Alexander's adventures made it into history books and even Bibles, the great carriers of his legend were the romances that concentrated on his more exotic escapades. Images of Alexander fighting elephants and lions, and here we have another inventive elephant, were placed side by side with his battles against dragons. In all cases, Alexander is shown dressed as a medieval knight rather than in classical garb. This tendency helped medieval readers make an immediate link between themselves and the great leader and lent verisimilitude to his adventures. Alexander, in the course of his travels, encountered creatures more and more fantastic. Different versions of the Romance of Alexander pitted him against everything ranging from a 3-horned pig-like thing to a whole series of battles against beasts which were part animal and part human. Whether they were men with faces on their chests or one-eyed giants, all these human-like creatures were nevertheless considered beasts by Alexander, lacking an immortal soul. As it says at one point in the text, quote, "Alexander found a wild man, and he had him burned because he lacked reason and was thus like a beast." In every image, Alexander is shown spearing, burning, or somehow otherwise fighting the vicious creatures he meets. He is never shown trying to speak with them or learn anything about them. As I mentioned before, images such as these verified the preconceptions of those in the Middle Ages that the lands outside Europe implicitly implied danger, and the best way to address that danger, apparently, was to attack it and kill it immediately. Romances such as that of Alexander awoke in medieval readers a desire to know more about the wonders of the East. In some cases, text was not even necessary. Pictures could be suggestive of whole other worlds. In this manuscript, a series of isolated snapshots of creatures from the ends of the earth occupy 7 pages, with simple captions identifying them. There are the trochocytes, who are extremely fast and can catch game on foot. Epiphagus, who have their eyes on their shoulders. Blemmii, with faces on their chest. The Amictrii were said to live on raw meat, necessitating, one must imagine, a more powerful jaw. Then there were the antipodes, with their feet on backwards. The sciopods, who protected themselves from the strong Indian sun with their single foot. The Maritimi, with 2 sets of keen eyes that were able to track out arrows in flight, and the troglodytes, who lacked the abilities to speak. All of these manners of creatures were thought to live in the regions variously known as India, Ethiopia, and the Antipodes. Antipodes literally means opposite ends of the earth, and even more specifically means opposite foot, which is why these guys are shown, the Antipodes, with their feet on backwards. Without a working knowledge of world geography throughout much of the Middle Ages, when these places were mentioned in texts, India, Ethiopia, the Antipodes, they were not references to actual places, but rather symbolic representations of the regions beyond Europe. In this world map from the 13th century, the monstrous races have been pushed to the very furthest corners of the earth, all grouped together, be they Indian, Ethiopian, or Antipodean. And here I show you a detail, and you can just make out creatures like the Blemmii. It was thought that if one could go far enough, one could reach these peoples and see them. Contrary to popular belief today, most people in the Middle Ages did not think of the world as flat, but already understood it as a sphere, as is evidenced by this map and this image from a later manuscript that actually pictures the Antipodean people walking upside down on the opposite ends of the earth. The gradual increase in travel from the Crusades in the 11th century through to the discovery of the New World by Europeans in the form of Christopher Columbus in 1492 led to all kinds of new information about the lands outside Europe and a voracity on the part of Europeans for travel logs of these intrepid explorers. One of the curious aspects of travelers' accounts of the East in the Middle Ages is that they all include the inherited information popular since Greek times, that is, that dragons, monstrous races, and unicorns all exist. In the popular text by the supposed explorer Sir John Mandeville, who set forth from England in the 14th century to journey to the East, he encounters all sorts of creatures. At first, he simply repulses the attacks of animals like bears and lions, but he quickly goes on to discover more fantastic beasts, such as dragons, the Blemmii, and the Cynocephali, a race of dog-headed men originally described in Greek times. Mandeville himself is shown to the side twice in traveling garb. In this way, the artist was emphasizing Mandeville's actual presence and the reliability of his eyewitness account. Scholars, however, regard Sir John Mandeville to be a fictitious person, and his accounts were cobbled together from previous sources, so it is not surprising to find these creatures. But what about when we turn to Marco Polo, who set out from Italy in the 13th century along the famous Silk Road to China? We know Marco Polo was a real person and that he really did travel to China. So what do we find in his account? It turns out that those in the Middle Ages, including Polo himself, had inherited hundreds of years of knowledge that would prove hard to controvert. Therefore, when Polo mentions savage men who live mostly on the animals they trap, what did medieval artists depict but this? Blemmii, cyapods, and one-eyed giants. And in a section in which Polo talks of a place where great hideous serpents lived, artists gave their audiences this: variations on the forms of dragons that had appeared in countless medieval manuscripts. Even Polo himself had trouble overcoming his own preconceptions. At one point in his text, he states that he found, quote, numerous unicorns, which are very big. They have hair like that of a water buffalo, feet like those of an elephant, and a horn in the middle of the forehead, which is black and very thick. It is an extremely ugly beast to look upon, and is not in the least that which our stories tell us of being caught in the lap of a virgin. In fact, it is altogether different from our notions. Confronted with the reality of a rhinoceros, Polo seems disappointed that the stories found in the bestiary of the unicorn did not match the beast before him. The artist of this manuscript wholly rejected the ugly creature Polo described and transformed it back into the beloved and noble white creature of legend. From other evidence, it becomes clear that Polo himself could not entirely give over all his expectations of what he would find in the East, or was at least unwilling to disillusion his readers. For in another part of his text, he describes in great detail the Cynocephali. Here they are on the island of Adamon, unconcernedly going about their business like any other group. When people such as Marco Polo, who went and saw these places with his own eyes, could not fully give up the idea of fantastic animals, is it any wonder that the vast majority of those in the Middle Ages who never went further than 10 or 20 miles beyond their homes in an entire lifetime believed in them as well? I hope you've seen ample evidence during the course of this lecture that medieval artists were unparalleled in their ability to depict the fantastic animals described in bestiaries, sacred texts, romances, and travelogues. But I wanted to offer you one more beast for your contemplation. It is a horrible hybrid creature, part animal, part reptile, and part bird, said to live at the ends of the earth. It is covered with fur and has teeth like any animal, But like a crocodile, it has legs on the side of its body ending in wickedly sharp claws, and it injects its prey with venom. At its extremities, it looks like a bird with webbed feet and a bill. It is said that this monstrosity can find other creatures, not by sight, not by smell, and not by hearing, but by detecting the very essence of life within them. Although this imaginative medieval illumination seems to entirely fit my description, I was actually telling you about a familiar creature, the lovable mixed-up platypus. When the first platypus pelt was brought back to Europe from Australia around the year 1800, naturalists were so convinced it was a fake that they cut it apart, trying to find the stitching that united a beaver skin to a duck bill. It is now known that the platypus's bizarre appearance is accompanied by weird biological characteristics. I'll bet that you knew that the platypus is the only egg-laying mammal, but did you know that it is also the only venomous mammal, with the male able to inject prey with poison from its hind legs? And did you read of the recent discovery that the platypus is the only mammal with the property of electrolocation, the ability to detect prey by sensing the electrical impulses of muscle movements, such as a heartbeat? This brings me back to a variation on the original question posited to me by the astute 10-year-old viewer of the medieval beast exhibition. Venomous mammals who detect the presence of electricity? Who would be stupid enough to believe that? In the Middle Ages, a combination of geographical isolation, reverence for inherited knowledge, and religious awe led to a belief in animals equally strange. Of course, we cannot know for sure that everyone believed in the existence of these animals. Albertus Magnus himself said when speaking of dragons killing elephants, quote, "In my estimation, this is merely a fabulous tale." Yet later in his work, after seriously discussing the traits of basilisks, manticores, and satyrs, he states, quote, "As I mentioned previously, many animals with composite forms exist in the world." It is also possible that some of these fantastic beasts were real phenomena that were simply misinterpreted over the ages. Narwhal horns found washed up on the shore lent credence to the myth of the unicorn. And you can see here the shape of it is very much like the shape there. And the Amictriae, whom we saw before, certainly could have been based on sightings of tribes like the Ubangi in Africa. But I would argue that the phenomenon of fantastic beasts was not solely a result of medieval misconception, willful gullibility, or ignorance. There seems to be a psychological need in all races of all periods to identify an other that makes us feel comfortable in our superiority and reminds us of the mystery of the universe, whether that other is actually believed to exist or not. In our modern world, if we no longer believe in violent, half-human, half-creature beasts like harpies, we are certainly familiar with the demonization of certain groups of people who are referred to as subhuman or bestial, as in this 1942 American magazine cover depicting the Emperor of China as a bloodthirsty bat. If we no longer believe in the terrors of hell full of devils who torture and torment, we have movie violent aliens who insist on maiming and killing. And although we fancy that our reliance on cutting-edge science presents an unbridgeable gulf between the Middle Ages and the modern age in terms of knowledge about real animals, there is still so much to discover about the natural world and the creatures that inhabit it. New species are being discovered every day. And some of them, like the platypus, are as unbelievable as anything that medieval artists dreamed up. What about this animal? Would you think it was real from a drawing? The Almiqui of Cuba, the pangolin of Africa, and the babirusa of Indonesia are just a few of the Earth's real creatures who continue to seem implausible. The delight with which we look at these creatures still is similar to what those in the Middle Ages experienced in opening their bestiaries and being told they were looking at lions, crocodiles, and satyrs. It was the artists who brought these fantastic animals alive for their readers, and they did it so well that artists hundreds of years later continued to turn back to the Middle Ages as a source of inspiration in depicting the unknown and unfathomable. In the Romantic era, images like Satan Exulting by William Blake certainly owed something to medieval images of Lucifer in the guise of a serpent-like animal. In the 19th century, Goya produced his series of black paintings, and they hearken back to what medieval artists felt awaited the sinful at the end of time. And behind this work, depicting a manticore by Tom Nechtel, a contemporary artist who frequently looks to manuscripts for insights, lies the century-long tradition of medieval bestiaries. Animals and their fantastic permutations fascinate us all. In the 13th century, Gervase of Tilbury summed it up by saying that marvels exist because of, quote, the desire of the human mind to hear and consume novelties. It is necessary that the old be changed into the new, the natural into the marvelous, and with respect to many familiar things, into the strange. For us, a medieval bestiary might not look like this, but it might look like this. Thank you.